Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 8th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. On Tuesday, November 4th, the voters of America delivered a potentially decisive blow to President Barack Obama in one of the most humiliating personal defeats in recent U.S. political history. Though Obama was not personally on the ballot, voters cast their ballots to defeat Democratic Party elected officials in the Senate, the House, and on the state level, punishing them for not rejecting Obama, who is the party's leader. Even the media, which had been favorable to Obama, had to admit this was a defeat of historic proportions for the president, a complete repudiation of his presidency, which some are calling the political impeachment of President Obama. This smashing loss has opened the door to what we at LaRouche PAC have been calling the post-Obama era. I think that as of last Tuesday night, our nation walked through that door and entered the post-Obama era. There are only two problems. First, Obama is still in the White House. While there are significant institutional forces which now realize that LaRouche has been right, that there is very little support for him to continue in office, he still has to be removed through the constitutional remedy of impeachment. And that is something which could happen relatively quickly, providing that those of you listening to this program act with us to make sure that those forces which recognize the danger to this country, if he remains in office, are mobilized to remove him. The second problem, however, is the real one, and the problem that very few Americans realize. Too many Americans have become accustomed to being little people, tolerating murderous injustices, as long as they're able to maintain some level of personal comfort. As that comfort level has declined due to global economic crisis, wars, disease, and so on, the bad habit of thinking small remains with us. On today's program, we will be discussing the transformation of human identity necessary to break out of that bad habit, which is necessary if we're to survive as a human race. What's required is the development of the ability to think strategically and creatively, which necessitates something which has been completely removed from education in the transatlantic world, what Friedrich Schiller called the education of the emotions. Joining me as a guest today to help you break with that potentially fatal problem of thinking small will be the incomparable strategic thinker Helga Zepp LaRouche. 30 years ago, Helga founded the Schiller Institute, named for Friedrich Schiller. At that time, the world was confronted with a real danger of nuclear war and the potential for a global financial collapse. In the subsequent 30 years, the oligarchical forces responsible for the war danger and the destruction of the physical economy have continued even more aggressively with those same policies, which today have brought us closer to the point at which mankind might be wiped out as a species. Yet at the same time, largely due to the tireless work of Helga and her husband, Lyndon LaRouche, global forces have come to recognize both the prescience of their warnings as well as the unique solutions they have developed. A recent conference of the Schiller Institute in Frankfurt, Germany, which we discussed on this program a couple weeks ago, brought together leading representatives of governments which have adopted the global programmatic outlook of the LaRouches, including notably those of the BRICS nations, with a special importance of the advances in China's space program to create a new planetary system. What Helga has insisted on above all else is that in order to deal with the reality of the present confluence of crises, we must achieve a paradigm shift in which the image of man shifts from that of an impotent consumer living in a struggle for the survival of the fittest in a Darwinian jungle, to that of being a creative producer. So Helga, welcome once again to the LaRouche Show.
Yeah, hello.
I'd like to begin by getting an update from you on the present strategic situation.
Well, it's I think I would describe it, we are somehow hanging between heaven and hell, because we are in a period especially now with the election result from Tuesday, you know, where it's not so clear yet what will be the alignment of forces in the United States. But apart from that crucial factor, you know, we are right now, on the one side, we see the danger of really sliding into a thermonuclear war. You know, today, the celebrations for the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall started actually in Berlin. And I just got off the phone with people there, and they were telling me that Gorbachev was giving a speech, which is quite amazing because, you know, if you remember the specific role Gorbachev played in the last phase of the Soviet Union, and, you know, that he was not exactly really liked by many Russians because many Russians thought that he had sold out the Soviet system. But now he made a speech which is amazing. He said Putin, in his Valdai speech, which was a couple of, you know, I would say 2 weeks ago, where Putin made an absolutely unbelievable speech in front of more than 100 diplomats and experts from many countries, in which he said, we are on the verge of a world war, and it's entirely due to the Cold War posture, which, you know, the West immediately started to go back to when the Soviet Union dissolved. And then he went into the true story of what happened in Ukraine and, you know, how the West has been lying and manipulating public opinion ever since. Now, Gorbachev completely endorsed what Putin had said, and that came to as a big surprise to many, because, you know, Gorbachev was not exactly on the same line of Putin a little while ago. And he said, you know, if we don't watch it, we will end up in a new world war. And he blamed the West of completely being irresponsible in respect to Ukraine and, you know, basically saying that the Cold War mentality is what is the problem. Now, I find that quite remarkable. And, you know, in a certain sense, it's a funny coincidence, because when Obama was in Berlin during the 2008 campaign, he spoke in front of 200,000 people who were all, you know, mesmerized and thought that Obama was the new Messiah. And when Gorby came to Berlin, everybody was screaming, Gorby, Gorby. So, you know, now you have the reverse situation. Many people are completely disappointed about Obama, not only in the United States, but internationally. And people all of a sudden realize that Gorbachev, whom they also hailed, is now speaking the same language like Putin. So I think the axioms of some people get some real cracks, and they have to rethink that maybe, you know, maybe if you go only by the public appearance of a PR image, that is not what leads you to the truth. Anyway, I just wanted to say that as a preface. I mean, to come to my point, we have a war danger which is extremely acute in Ukraine. I mean, basically, Poroshenko, whose government is riddled with Nazis, is again bombing the population in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas region. And, you know, it's extremely dangerous. I mean, I heard a report this morning in the German radio which said that just one match be lit and you could have a big war. Mm-hmm. Then you have, naturally, an extremely volatile situation in the Middle East with the ISIS, the Iran P+5. A final negotiation is scheduled, the final date of these negotiations is for the 24th of November, and there are many, many efforts to derail that. If that is derailed, all hell will break loose on top of what is going on in the Middle East already. So we are really sitting on a powder keg. On the other side, and this is why I say we are between hell and heaven, you have a dynamic of maximum economic integration, economic development from the side of the BRICS countries. And, you know, the APEC summit already started on a lower level of experts, and it will culminate between the 9th and the 11th in Beijing, you know, in 2 days from now. And we can expect major initiatives to come from that, going in the direction of further integration of not only the BRICS countries, but also many countries in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa. And one of the very important news is that it seems that between Abe of Japan and Xi Jinping, the preconditions have been established that they can meet and that they want to resume more normal relations between Japan and China, which, if that succeeds, would really eliminate one of the trouble areas, you know, which, you know, could lead potentially to a military confrontation. So if the Japanese-Chinese relationship gets cooled down and more normalized, that is also a very important development.
And Helga, that seems to have come out of nowhere, at least in the visible universe, because everything we've seen has been going in the other direction. So this is an example of how rapidly things can change under these circumstances.
Yeah, I think it probably has to do with the fact that Japan is practically bankrupt. You know, they are now involved in a quantitative easing, which makes even the money printing of the Federal Reserve look like the proverbial peanuts. They are now printing so much money, $1 billion they inject per year, and then on top of that, the Bank of Japan has the order to buy up as many state bonds as needed. And even some financial commentators said this is like morphine to a death patient. You know, it may take the pain a little bit away, but it quickens the death. So I think they have a good reason to come to terms with China, and rather than being on a military bellicose projection to try to benefit from the incredible dynamic which comes from India, China, Russia, South Korea. And it's to the benefit if all of these countries cooperate, because obviously the problems we have in the world are so gigantic that we don't need to have useless wars on top of it, but we should rather focus on what we all should solve, you know, the common aims of mankind.
Well, as I opened the program, I wanted to, there are actually two reasons I wanted you to be on today. One is because we are in the 30th anniversary year from the founding of the Schiller Institute, but also in 2 days we'll be celebrating once again Friedrich Schiller's birthday. And there was a specific idea you had in mind 30 years ago for founding the Schiller Institute, which even many in our own organization sometimes seem to forget or put aside. But as I remember, one of the important points you made is that statecraft has to be shaped by these higher philosophical ideals of Schiller. And I'd like you to just reflect on the fact that over the 30 years, the Schiller Institute, which started with a big bang. I mean, didn't we have over 100 or 80 countries represented at the founding conference in Wiesbaden? But all of a sudden, in the last years, we're seeing the growth of importance of the Schiller Institute and yourself in China, Mr. LaRouche's role in Russia. So I'd like you to just reflect a little bit on how you've seen this, what you intended when you launched it, and how you've seen that come to fruition.
Well, you know, Friedrich Schiller was very precious to me from early on, because I had the fortunate situation that I had three German teachers who insisted that we really get familiar with the classics. And from all the people I ever read in school and later until the present day, I still think that Schiller has the most beautiful image of man of anybody. Not only is he unbelievably optimistic about the true nature of man, that every man has the potential to become a genius, that a totally humanist society in which, you know, people relate to each other as beautiful souls, that is achievable. And you know, it struck me always that, you know, what our society needs the most is the idea of, you know, how the true creative potential of human beings could actually lead to a more human relationship, not only among people, you know, in a family, in a city, but also among nations. And, you know, that's why I, at a certain point, I kept coming back to Schiller again and again in my life. But then in 1978, I had some circumstances which forced me to be more or less, concentrated for half a year where I couldn't do much else. So I reread everything Schiller wrote in depth, and I studied it, you know, and did some additional research and so forth. So then when in the beginning of the 80s, the tension between Germany and the United States was extremely high because of the middle-range missile crisis, the SS-20 and the Pershing 2. And I decided to found an institute which would put the relation among nations on a completely different grounding than, you know, than subversion, spying, surveillance, coups, you know, the usual kind of foreign relations we have today. And I said we have to have a completely different conception of how nations should relate to each other. And then I thought about it, and I came to the conclusion that the best idea, the best mind, the most beautiful conception of man, that is really expressed by Friedrich Schiller, and that it would be extremely helpful for the further advancement of humanity if more people would really not only know Schiller, but start to think on his sublime level of thinking. And that is why I gave this effort to have an institute essentially improving the relation among nations, to give that his name. And we started then, you know, as you said, in the founding conferences we had in Arlington in Virginia, we had 50 nations coming in with their flags, with their national anthems, marching into the room, and even bigger in Wiesbaden. And then, you know, basically it grew very, very quickly to become, you know, not only an instrument of communication among Europe and the United States, but especially between the West and the developing countries. And, you know, we started to translate Schiller's work in many languages. And, you know, I think, you know, if you think that 30 years is on one side a long time, but on the other side it's really not such a long time, I think what we have accomplished is that the Schiller Institute, in the eyes of many people in many countries, has become sort of the opposite of the present design of empire. You know, the idea that you have to have geopolitical subversion and color revolution and all of these terrible things. So the Schiller Institute has become, both in terms of the economic policies, you know, the idea of the world land bridge, the idea of development programs for Africa, for Latin America, for Asia. It has become like a conception of people who want to have a better world. And also in terms of the cultural idea, you know, I was very, very happy when, for example, Xi Jinping went to India in September, and he gave there a speech in which he did exactly, you know, what I always said people should do when they want to have a good relationship to another country. Namely, he focused entirely only on the best and positive cultural periods in Indian history. And he did that with such a deep knowledge. He said he loved Indian history since he was a young man. And, you know, then he gave a speech which proved that he knows Indian history absolutely in depth, you know, and that is exactly what we need, because when relations relate to each other, they should not focus on the negative points. Because if you just say, you know, you have done that crime and this mishap and this misfortune, you can get to World War III really quickly. Because, you know, if each person points to the other one and says, I don't like your nose, your left eye hangs down half a meter, you have a wart on your cheek, you know, you can start World War III with everybody. But if you, on the other side, you say, oh, I like your potential because you expressed it in such a beautiful way in this act or in this activity. I mean, then you're talking about the United States. You know, nowadays, America is regarded as Abu Ghraib, drones. You know, the image of America is terrible in the world right now. But if you want to improve the relationship, you know, and get America back, then you focus on the American Revolution, the American Constitution, on Lincoln, on Franklin D. Roosevelt, on John F. Kennedy, on Martin Luther King. And you bring forth the best traditions, and that then resonates. You know, and if each nation does that with the other one, you can reach higher levels of communication and peaceful orders. And I think the method of the Schiller Institute is working. I can see it working in the policies among the BRICS countries, how they relate to each other. And that is actually what humanity should do.
Well, I think also if people go to the website and look at the proceedings from the recent Schiller conference in Frankfurt, where what was explicit in the deliberation and in the cultural work is replacing geopolitics with a renaissance. You know, I think it was very clear in that conference, and maybe you'd like to say something about it, because as you know, we have not covered it enough in the United States, but that event brought together a culmination of the 30 years, but actually put it in advance into the future. So this idea of replacing geopolitics with a renaissance, I think, is the only way you can get into this new era.
Yes, because, you see, my husband was saying earlier today, you know, that what you see with the Chinese lunar program, which I think you have discussed on this show several times, basically, you know, the Chinese are making very big progress to advance their lunar missions with the aim to eventually mine helium-3 from the moon, bring it back to Earth, and use it for fuel for a fusion economy. If that would happen, we are entering a completely new phase of the evolution of mankind, namely that we can gain energy directly from the physical process rather than going through steam engines and turbines and producing energy that way. And that will totally revolutionize the role of man in the universe, because it will not only give us fusion power on Earth and therefore energy and raw material security, but it will enable us to use it for propulsion in space. And that means that we will be able to completely differently think about what is the role of man, not only on the planet, but in the universe. Now, what Lynn, my husband, said this morning is that we are clearly seeing in these developments a planetary role of mankind, where, you know, you can already see the nation state, which is under threat and in danger right now by globalization, will remain important, because it is the expression of the culture and the language and the, you know, the identity of people, because you cannot replace the way how the mother tongue expresses mm-hmm. itself in, you know, in poetry, in literature, and I mean that will remain. But, you know, the narrow-minded understanding of only thinking about your nation, of becoming a chauvinist, that will be superseded by having the identity of civilization in those areas where, you know, we all are, you know, human. For example, we all are depending on good medical science. We are all dependent on good composers, on good poets. And these are not national issues, because if you have somebody who becomes a really true great scientist, he is universal. If somebody is a great composer, like Bach or Beethoven, he stops to be a German. He's a universal addition to universal history. And I think what we will see, if we don't blow ourselves up in the short term, which is unfortunately a possibility. But what you can already see and get a smell of is a future phase of evolution of mankind where all of us will have more a view like the astronauts who have been in outer space, and they all report the same thing, that when you look at the planet Earth from out there, you have a completely different understanding of what humanity is all about. You have a view of the future. And that happens to be also something which Schiller emphatically demanded. For example, if you read the Aesthetical Letters, he says, you know, the artist must, the moment he is practically born, immediately flee his contemporary environment and go to the future, go to a more golden age, which sometimes only exists in the imagination, and then coming back, you know, with a completely different conception, and then, you know, take care of what needs to be changed in the present. So don't be a slave of the present. Have a vision of the future, and then work in the present to implement that ideal conception. And that is a method of thinking which is the only method which always has brought mankind ahead. And that is why you find in Schiller a methodology which is really absolutely beautiful and applicable for all kinds of situations, which is why I want to encourage our listeners that they really should read Schiller, because, you know, it's so beneficial. For example, Schiller's dramas, I can promise you, you will never look at a criminal story again in your life, because you will fall asleep by boredom. With boredom as in comparison. If you read the dramas of Schiller, they are so full of suspense that you cannot stop, because everything follows so absolutely lawfully out of each other that you cannot stop until you are finished. And, you know, if you even have the luck to see a good performance, which unfortunately is very rare these days, it's even better, naturally. So Schiller is so rich, you know, he has developed so many aesthetical laws for poetry, for drama, for tragedy, for, you know, but also philosophical writings about the sublime, about theory of art. You will find that it's the most enriching thing you can do.
Well, I want to take up a couple of those themes in a moment, but I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's November 8th, 2014, and we're speaking today with Helga Zepp LaRouche, the founder of the Schiller Institute and the leader of probably the most important, the most important political party in Germany, the BUSO. Helga, one of the issues that we see bandied about in the United States is this whole question of freedom. And just reviewing for a class I'm going to do today some of the writings that you mentioned of Schiller, freedom is very important to Schiller, but he has a totally different conception than you get from the right-wing Republicans in the United States who talk about freedom to choose and free markets and freedom from government intervention. They use the term over and over and over without the slightest conception of what freedom means in the context of the human struggle over many, many centuries to develop a human civilization. And I'd like you to talk about that, because I think this again gets to this point you're making, that the idea of freedom that's presented most of the time is a form of enslavement to one's senses, to one's immediate passions, as opposed to this higher quality of freedom. So I'd like you to discuss that a little bit.
Well, I think Schiller is rightly called the poet of freedom, and I think it was Frederick Douglass who even coined that word for him. Schiller's conception of freedom is an inner freedom. I mean, if you read all his theoretical writings, the Aesthetical Letters, but also many others, you find that he was always concerned that there is no force applied to inner human behavior, which is why he, for example, really objected to Immanuel Kant and his categorical imperative, because Kant said, you know, you should always not do to others what you don't want to be done to yourself. And, you know, Schiller said that is maybe good for the lower level people and the slaves who, you know, they it's better to, you know, you can use that Kantian method before you become a pig. You better think that way. But it's not for the beautiful souls. Because, you know, Schiller, who loved the inner freedom so much, did not want to even watch the procedure with which so-called moral people suppress their impulses to be moral. Because he said it's just not worthy of the dignity of man to be forced. So he developed instead this idea that you have to develop yourself, both your reason, but even more important, your emotions to the level of reason. So that, you know, most people, when they try to be good people or moral people, they say, okay, I have to suppress my impulses and therefore I force myself to do good. Schiller says
it makes them unhappy to do good.
Yeah, very much so. And you see these people who have bitter faces and they feel so holy, but they feel terribly unhappy. So Schiller said, no, what you can do is you can train your emotions so that you can blindly follow them at every instant, because they will never ask you to do something which reason would not command as well. And I think this is very important. I mean, this is an idea which also comes from Lessing earlier, who said, you know, people have to train their emotions to be compassionate, to be, the notion in Schiller is Empfindungsvermögen. I have never found a good translation in English. Empfindungsvermögen is something like the ability of a human being to sensuously grasp the entire world with your reason and your emotions and absorb it in and then act on that basis. I know that sounds like a very complicated explanation, but it is the ability to be open to the world and compassionate and loving. And if you do that, then you can try to educate that feeling. And, you know, both Lessing and also Schiller, they said you can do that, for example, with great drama, because in great classical drama, you can, in a playful way, rehearse that what you need in real life. Because in real life, you're sometimes confronted with shocking situations, and you know, they're so overwhelming so that you can't think about it and you do something stupid. But if you look, for example, at the great classical historical drama about which Schiller also has written, you know, he has written this beautiful writing about the theater as a moral institution, where he says the ordinary person, the barber, the baker, the, you know, shoemaker, they go to the theater and they are being catapulted from their small life circumstances onto the stage where they see the large issues of mankind. And they see with Virgin of Orleans or Don Carlos or Maria Stuart or Wilhelm Tell, they see big issues and they see how, you know, the heroes of these plays have to make decisions which decide over the fate of their nation or their environment for generations to come. And they go through the conflicts with the actors on the stage, with the heroes on the stage, and that way they're being elevated to think big. So the person who goes into the theater is a normal, ordinary person, but the person who comes out of the theater has been transformed to think completely different, and his mind has been widened, and he's challenged, and he has been transformed. And Schiller says, for example, in the introduction to The Bride of Messina, that when confronted with great classical art, a force is ignited in the heart and in the soul of the person, which does not go away even if the performance is ended. Now, that is very important, because all of you know that, because if you go to something uplifting, like a great performance of the Ninth Symphony or, you know, some other very, very uplifting piece of classical work, you are transformed. You are more sublime. You think greater. Your emotions are purified. Your mind thinks better. You're just totally evoked as a creative individual.
Well, and this puts a special responsibility on the artist, because the artist can't just do something that makes the artist feel good, but has this responsibility for those who view the art.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the opposite is also true, that if you allow yourself to go into some degraded performance, let it be the famous Regie Theater, which, you know, nowadays almost all classical works are being degraded through the absurd views of the person who puts it on stage, or you go to some bestial, black gothic rock concert or some satanic horror show, and you expose yourself to that, your mind is ruined for days to come. So, you know, I think people have to watch much more, you know, if you look at the present culture from the standpoint of Schiller, of Bach, of Beethoven, of Shakespeare, of Shelley, you know, if you look at the present culture, it is absolutely degrading people and turning them into more bestial people every time they do that to themselves. Now, that is why classical art is so extremely important, because you are the master of what you become, and if people would only pay half as much attention to the beauty of their soul as they go into a fitness studio and try to form that part of the biceps to be on that angle as compared to some other muscle. You know, I have sometimes seen a person, you know, studying it's absurd how people, you know, how much attention they pay to such ridiculous things, why they don't pay any attention, you know, to what they become as a human being.
Helga, another area of Schiller's work, which I think gets into this question of the universal, the search for the common aims of mankind, is his approach to history, where for him, history is not this banal concept of you study history to avoid the mistakes of the past, but you actually look for that which is universal and look for that which can guide you in the future from the past. And again, this is a number of his writings, the Revolt of the Netherlands and on the 30 Years' War, but also his critical lecture on universal history at Jena. I think this gets at the question of what you were just talking about earlier, about appreciating and understanding the cultural development of other nations as a component of achieving peace.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, he has a historical methodology, which is in one sense very much like what my husband has been independently developing, namely to be able to have a prescience. Now, my husband is famous all over the world for his unique ability to identify developments before they happen, you know. For example, in 1971, he predicted the present financial crisis. He predicted in 1984 that the Soviet Union would disintegrate in 5 years, which is exactly what happened. And I could give you hundreds of examples where he was absolutely on the mark. And what is the method which enables somebody to make an adequate, correct forecast of what will happen in the future? And that is an absolute unique human quality, because no animal has any conception about the future. If you tell your dog, let's go for a walk tomorrow, the dog will run to the door and has just heard the word walk. You know, but there's no way how you can communicate tomorrow. While human beings can do that, and Schiller also, you know, basically was able to identify those things which are the principles behind developments. And in order to accomplish that, he said you have to in some sense study history not chronologically, you know, from what happened 3,000, 2,000, 1,000 years ago, but you have to start with what works in the present, conceptualize that, and then find out how that can be traced back as a principle, naturally always with the historical predicates and so forth. But that method is absolutely unique, and that, for example, in parentheses, enabled Schiller to find out something about the real historical Wallenstein as compared to what was transmitted by the Habsburgs in terms of who Wallenstein supposedly was. And he was then able to put that in the great drama Wallenstein on the stage. And historians, many centuries later, then commented and said that Schiller was able to identify out of almost no historical records, nevertheless, he identified the true figure of Wallenstein because he could put things together in a way which was the superior method. And you can find the description of that in Schiller's 30 Years' War history, in I think it's the end of the first chapter, where he describes that. So what Schiller gives you, therefore, is not only a clue and a key to poetry, we should talk about that also, about what is the what are the principles of great classical drama, for example, this idea of a punctum saliens, which we should also talk about.
Right.
But he gives you a historical method. He is one of the greatest philosophers, and, you know, he is the best psychologist I can know. Even Sigmund Freud attributed a lot of his method to Friedrich Schiller, and I would say he's much superior because he had an idea of overcoming. You know, modern psychology just is, you know, bathing in insights and then getting the person to live with his neurosis. Well, what Schiller does is he identifies the most inner thoughts and feelings of the soul, because he has an insight like nobody else. But then he gives you a method to overcome whatever is the problem, which is a completely different idea. If you have a problem and you grow beyond it, you become a bigger person. So I think that there is so much to gain from Schiller that I just hope I can inspire our listeners that they immediately run to their bookshelf and get the complete work of Schiller, which they all have in their bookshelf, I hope. If not, you can call in, and we have the translation for volumes you can get from us.
Yes, I was just going to say that people can go to the new website that we have, the newparadigm.schillerinstitute.com, for the conferences, the series of conferences that we've had in the last 2 years on this question of creating a new paradigm, but also call your local LaRouche office, and we have copies of we have 4 volumes of Schiller's works. And you were talking about the question of poetry and the soul, and I think what's most interesting to me in Schiller's poetry is that it's almost as though his soul is laid bare for you to get his insights. For example, in his poem The Artists, and you know, I know you want to talk about that, so give us a little insight into what to look for in Schiller's poetry.
Well, I mean, first of all, Schiller has written himself that poetry is almost the only area where the divided person can reunite with himself and become a harmonious person again. And, you know, already in his time, you know, which was the end of the 18th, beginning of 19th century, he said that the problem with human beings was that they were so torn apart and so, you know, divided in themselves because of the circumstances. I mean, remember, this was the period, you know, of the French Revolution and then, you know, the beginning of Napoleon's rise. So, but, you know, obviously, if Schiller would be alive today and walk around among us, he would say, oh my God, people were living in an idealistic idyllic time during my time, and now the world is so much more ugly and horrible. But he would still insist that poetry is extremely important. Why? Because, you know, what happens in a poem, in contrast to prose, in prose you just say whatever content you want to say, and then it's there, black on white, so to speak. But what happens in a good poem, in a classical poem, is you have a poetical idea, and then you develop that idea in an artistic way. You sort of make what you call in music a thorough composition of that idea. And then when the poem is completed, there is a meaning in the poem which is not in the prosaic text. But the mind is forced to conceptualize that higher truth which comes across through the specific form of the poetry, which must be in some form, you know, bound, you know, like rhyme, strophes, and similar metrical considerations. And depending what the idea is, you choose the meter, you choose the form of the poem, and it all works together. The form is very important, which is why the Romantics did such a miserable job to try to take the form apart, and that led to the complete destruction of classical art to the present form of complete deconstructionism, where nothing is left. So form is very important. And, you know, Schiller had the highest requirement to the poet who writes poems, because he said, at least for the moment when he is writing that poem, he has to idealize himself to an ideal human being. And, you know, only then can he dare to move his audience. Because, you know, the ability of art to move people is known, but in order not to violate the freedom of the audience, you know, the poet has to be on the highest level of his humanity. And that is an individual contribution. It's not something you can do in a collective or so, you know, because Schiller also says the highest thing the artist has to give us is his ennobled individuality. Mm-hmm. Now, that is very beautiful, and that is why it is so enriching, because when you study poetry in this way, or even try to write poems yourself according to the standard, what you do is you get access to that faculty of your mind which is where creativity is located. Because by writing something which is not in the prose, to give it a meaning, a beautiful poetical idea, you have to create something new in your mind. And when you are finished with writing the poem, you realize that you have just added some faculty in your own mind by doing so. And naturally, if you study poetry, the same thing happens. So it is very important, and especially because of all the areas of art, I would say the only other area probably is the German Lied, because, you know, Lim has called that the Rosetta Stone of art at some point, because when you have a poem and then a classical composer who sets that poem to music, like Schubert or Mozart or Beethoven, Schumann, Brahms, what happens is you do another level of solo composition, and, you know, it is simply the most important, I call it the lyrical side of the human being, and that lyrical side is so precious, you know, because what is the problem with modern culture? You have people who are rude, they are two-dimensional, they are, you know, just flat, you know. If people who are trained in classical culture look at the present contemporary people, they get horrified, simply because, you know, this sweetness or this fineness, what I call the lyrical quality, is so completely lacking, and it's almost impossible to even communicate what it is because people have no resonance of it. Which is why the studying of classical poetry is so absolutely crucial.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking about that of Beethoven's famous statement about how hard it is to set Schiller to music, because he said to do that, the composer has to be over and above the poem, and it's almost impossible to do with Schiller because it's almost perfect as it's written.
Yes, that's why he liked to compose Beethoven, Goethe better.
Yes, but he did a couple of nice things for us with the Ninth Symphony, where he took Schiller's poem. Well, Helga, on just to go one step further on this question of art, because if you look at most so-called art today, it's either to shock or to present what's a kind of realism, which is to show people in their ugliest. And, you know, our culture has degenerated when you think about the social media, video games, and so on. The idea of Schiller and Goethe sitting in a garden discussing these profound ideas from the Greeks to their time, it's hard to imagine how to recreate that. How do we go about recreating it? Because I was just in a meeting this morning with a couple of people who were very serious about what to do now that the Obama's been cast aside by the voters. What has to be done? And one of them brought up that a lot of parents are horrified by what they're seeing their children get in the schools. And he was asking, how could you begin an educational reform movement? So I told him I would ask you that, and you know, in this context, I'd like to throw that out to you. What do we have to do to bring this different conception of man into our education system?
Well, I have said since a long time that I think classical music is the way to do it, and classical poetry as a you know, sort of sibling of that. Because if you think what the slaves in the United States did with the spiritual, you know, I mean, the spiritual was a very beautiful art form to express some terrible condition, or, you know, how to overcome it, or, you know, how to steal away to get to another place. you know, all the beautiful spirituals which you know, were sung by the slaves as a way of getting this inner freedom. And, you know, then naturally you had certain composers who even added them in making them really almost truly classical compositions. And I think the same thing is true with classical music, because classical music, contrary to you know, pop music or whatever form of modern music, is exactly doing that to the human mind, that it sets it free. And, you know, in a certain sense, what we need to fight for is beauty. Our present culture is so ugly. I mean, just to give you an image what I mean, you all or many of our listeners either have seen it or they can easily access it in YouTube. Take the national anthem sung by Marian Anderson. I think Kennedy asked her to do that. And then compare that with Beyoncé singing the same national anthem. And there you have exactly, you know, what is true beauty, with Marian Anderson standing there, very simple, very, you know, her heart was on her lips, and she got people to almost cry because it was such an unbelievable emotion which she could generate in the audience. And then compare that to Beyoncé, who was lip-syncing, which became a big scandal afterwards. And then you had this movie production in which you had Obama and Michelle Obama standing there like socialist realism figures looking in the far. But it was all Hollywood, and it's all glamour, and it's all glossy, but it doesn't move the soul. It's completely... Schiller has a passage in the Aesthetical Letters which completely fit that, where he says that people who are only left to the senses, you know, you can see them, how they are getting all excited, they are drooling, their eyes widen, you know, and you should look for this passage. It's a very good description of what happens if people only react to the senses. Mm-hmm. So I think what we need is we need to have people who have fight for beauty. They should. You cannot reject that children in the school are being taught the 58 genders already at the age of 5, and then have Pokemon being the entry track for three-dimensional horror videos. I mean, this is all ugly. The whole thing is meant to turn the mind into a new slave in modern forms. And these children become autistic. They listen to, they listen to their PlayStation. They play with it all day. They are not capable to deal with the real world anymore because they are so absorbed with this virtual reality, which is ugly, that they fail as human beings. And this is why many young people just have no clue how to organize their lives. So the only way...
Well, and it also destroys any sense of a social identity because there's no interaction with other people.
Exactly. And that is why the only way to counter that is go back to the basics, go back to the classics, go back to classical music, learn an instrument, teach your child learning a classical instrument, learn bel canto singing. Singing is accessible for every human being if you are 2 years old or if you are 95. You know, you can learn singing, and people should start to do that, and that way develop the inner inoculation against ugliness. I mean, look what the Chinese are doing. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese musicians, people who are singing in operas all over the world, and, you know, also Japanese, South Koreans, you know, you have many, many people who, many Asians who have discovered the beauty of classical music. And in Europe and in the United States, we absolutely have to revive it if we are to save our own cultures.
Well, I think that as we're coming toward the end of the program, we will be in various parts of the country over the next month honoring the 255th birthday of Friedrich Schiller, which will be on Monday. But I think people should check with your local office. I know we have an event in Boston. We're going to have one in Houston. What we do in Houston every year is we take a section of a drama, an important drama, and we have a Joe Jennings spectacular where you actually have a dress and perform a section of a play. You should have seen our Wallenstein's camp scene, Helga. But I think this is something that bringing this kind of real human communication back into politics. And I'd like to finish by just having you reflect on this question of Schiller's role in shaping what would be a human statecraft.
Well, that is very important because he has written about that as well basically developing this notion that each individual has an ideal state within him or in herself. And, you know, basically rather than being alienated from the state, you know, which is today absolutely the case because people reject big government, they hate bureaucracy, they hate Washington, they hate the Congress. But, you know, it's a completely different idea if you are, in a certain sense, carrying in yourself the republic. And obviously a republic can only function if every human being in that state is participating in self-government. So I think Schiller's ideas of, you know, what the state and what the life in a functioning republic can be are absolutely the way to really solve this conflict because, you know, it's the question of the inner beauty of the soul because, you know, it's the freedom, the inner freedom of the individual which unleashes everything. So, you know, I would like people to really maybe start with the aesthetical letters to think about and then go into the great classical dramas of Schiller because there you have the example of statecraft and what a state should be.
Right.
For example, if you look at the Wilhelm Tell, that is a lesson in statecraft. You know, it's one of the fantastic works also celebrating, in one sense, the ideas of the American Revolution, because if you compare the Declaration of Independence with the Whitley Oath, which is part of this Wilhelm Tell play, it's almost the same identical formulation, that there are inalienable rights hanging in the stars eternally, and that when the circumstances in reality become intolerable, that every human being has the right to take these rights, these inalienable rights in the stars, and bring them down to earth. I mean, he says it much more beautiful than I can do it
now. And I think, Helga, we've run out of time, but I think that's a great place to stop, because that's what the post-Obama era is all about. Each of you reaching up into the stars with your ideal self and ending the tyranny of popular opinion and sense certainty. So, Helga, thank you very, very much for joining us today and giving us some insights on this higher level as to how to create this post-Obama era. So that will do it for our program today. Remember, you can look up on the Internet the Schiller Institute website, which has a number of Helga's writings on Friedrich Schiller, as well as translations of poems and also reviews of plays and operas. And then join us next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of The LaRue Show. So thank you, Helga.
Yes, bye-bye.